Available now from Graphic Audio.
Do you know what they're calling one of their leaders?
Who, God Voice?
The Togairu Rebels. One band of raiders has named their leader Ashwarawu. Do you know what that means? He who kills without mercy.
Our enemy is a Roo called Ashwarawu.
A mighty leader?
A coward who strikes at the vulnerable and retreats to the shadows. But of late, he grows bolder, and his attacks come nearer and nearer to Daryan.
I will line the steps with the heads of Chazole dog warriors.
You cannot fight a war alone. You have heard of Ashwarawu?
Ashwarawu gathers warriors as he roams from village to village. The baronies fear him.
We know where he is. Or we know at least where you can go to be found.
Ashwarawu.
You are far from any village, woman.
I am where I'm meant to be.
Who are you, and why have you come?
I am Bryn Dariel. I have no home, and I was a wanderer until very recently when I happened upon a village controlled by a despised Yatol. I killed the Yatol, and his Chezole lackey beside him. And so again, I have no home.
Then you are welcome as one of my warriors.
How did you find us?
Perhaps you are not as well hidden as you believe.
How he found us is not as important as why he found us. What do the Shistatu see in our struggles that would so interest you, Mystic?
I have come to Togai to learn.
What is there to learn, Mystic? How to fight? How to die?
Perhaps how to live.
The rats! Kill all of them! Charge!
Ashwarawu!
Don't miss the cataclysmic action in part 2 of the Demon Wars Saga Book 6, Transcendence. Available now in Graphic Audio.
And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Jerry Ahern's The Survivalist. Narrated by Terrence Aselford. With performances by Eric Messner, Nanette Savard, Michael Glenn, Ken Jackson, Michael John Casey, Dylan Lynch, Laura Quinn Anderson, Yasmin Toison, Tony Nam, M.B. Van Dorn, Ren Casey, David Coyne, Scott McCormick, Elizabeth Jernigan, and Mort Shelby. Survivalist number 24, Blood Assassins. The knife in his hand was double-edged, forming a triangle with long equilateral sides and an extremely narrow base. The sides made the double edges, and they were sharpened past any usefulness as a working blade, good only for shaving and one thing else. Helmut Spitz drove the blade of his dagger into the sentry's carotid artery. Spitz's left hand was closed over the about-to-be-dead man's mouth in order to stifle any sort of sound. Spitz was not worried, concerning his eyes, over the blood spray that the torn artery would produce because he wore a gas mask fitted with goggles. Most of mankind's physical ills had been conquered since those days, but Spitz was careful. There was no reason compelling him to be otherwise. The sentry's body sagged into Spitz's arms, and only then did Spitz withdraw the weapon. Helmut Spitz dragged the dead body back into the shadows, holding his breath in order to enable him to hear any sounds which might trigger a mental alarm. His left hand was still over the mouth of the now dead man, on the off chance that there might yet be a death rattle. None of the sentries in this vast hall was helmeted, and that was a positive advantage to Spitz and his unit, aiding in unhampered access to the neck and voiding any possibility for potentially noise-producing headgear to tumble to the marbleized synthetic stone of the floor. The cryogenic storage facility at New Germany in Argentina, perhaps because of the two bodies still entombed here, seemed cathedral-like. Ceiling of great height, vaulted and buttressed, but the walls windowless. The floor of this, the main room, was enormous, nearly adequately sized for a soccer field, barren of ornamentation. And the guards were sworn to secrecy concerning this location. Although chosen, it was supposedly a great honor to stand watch here, from among the most trusted men in the crack units of the Transglobal Alliance, they filled a need that was essentially ceremonial. After all, the cryogenic facility was fully self-contained and self-sustaining, located in such a remote spot that most conventional forms of access were impossible. The entryways were guarded, equipped with computerized sentry systems, and armored against anything short of a nuclear strike. The man whom Helmut Spitz had just killed was a German, but the guards at the entryway, killed only moments earlier, were Chinese and American, the latter a Marine in dress blues, as they were called. It was a Chinese, a descendant of one of the survivors of the Second City, who had betrayed the installation, allowed Spitz and his commandos entry. The man harbored hate for the Rourke family, the Rourkes causing the defeat of the Second City and responsible for its fall from power. The Chinese was among the few surviving believers who worshipped in the Second City's death cult. Spitz had the man killed for his troubles because he disliked traitors. The two bodies which slept in this supposedly impregnable repository were, at this point in human history, of enormous value. One of the sleepers, Spitz heard closer to dead than alive, was Sarah Rourke, the wife of the hated Dr. John Rourke, nemesis of the Führer, Dietrich Zimmer, and the Führer's son, who was leader of Eden and heir apparent to the Reich, Martin Zimmer. Sarah Rourke was also Martin Zimmer's mother. The second sleeper, by all reports fully healthy, was another historic enemy of National Socialism. He was Generaloberst Wolfgang Mann, key to the overthrow of the leader 125 years ago and the establishment of the hated Democratic Republic of New Germany under the betraying leadership of Herr Dr. Dieter Bern. Next to the Rourke family, with whom Generaloberst Mann chose voluntarily to sleep 125 years ago, Mann was the Reich's greatest enemy. The Bern government still survived through the generations, still harbored racial inferiors within it, still pandered to the democracies of the Transglobal Alliance led by the United States, still condemned National Socialism, without which it would not have existed in the first place. All of that would soon change, and the work done here would facilitate that circumstance, Helmut Spitz believed, because he was told so in a private briefing by Dietrich Zimmer. Destiny. In the days prior to the night of the war, the descendants and some few survivors of the Third Reich, men who had actually touched Hitler's hand, heard his voice, seen his glorious face, marched in his heroic armies, planned for the destruction of the lesser races in the aftermath of inevitable warfare between the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics and the United States of America. These magnificent few planned for their progeny to survive, return, rule. For this purpose, in what was then Argentina, a mountain redoubt was built at enormous expense and populated with the cream of Nazi youth from around the world. For five centuries, while the Earth's surface was uninhabitable, the civilization which would rule the new Earth prospered. Science, technology, all disciplines thrived under the enlightened leadership of National Socialism. But gradually, because persons of inferior race had been able to secretly insinuate themselves into what was known as New Germany, a small group of heavily armed traitors arose. They were led by Generaloberst Wolfgang Mann, and with the help of the infamous Herr Dr. Rourke, overthrew by violence and deception the rightful government. Evidence subsequently came to light, Spitz recalled, that Generaloberst Wolfgang Mann's great-great-grandmother was suspected to be a Jewess. The men under Spitz in his Abteilung each knew the historic purpose of what would be done here this day, and to a man, the brave young ones were ready to die for the SS, for the party, for the mission, and for their Hauptsturmführer, Spitz himself. The body of the sentry was now fully withdrawn behind the support pillar at the entrance to the main gallery, and Spitz wiped clean his blade on the dead man's clothes, sheathing the steel. Soon, the assault. The hall was longer than it was wide. Pillars of shimmering synthetic marble were set every 4 meters apart, ranking from the low, arched entryway where Spitz crouched to what had become a shrine to the forces aligned against National Socialism. At the hall's furthest end, before the ranked flags of the nations of the Transglobal Alliance, lay 7 coffin-shaped transparent chambers, 5 of these open, 2 only, one just to the right of the centermost chamber, which had been that of Dr. Rourke, and the other on the far left side, operational. These latter 2 cryogenic chambers were illuminated from within, swirling clouds of gas, a translucent blue in color, surrounding the bodies cocooned there. In the chamber just to the right of that in which the vile Dr. Rourke had slept, Frau Rourke lay in uneasy repose. In the other chamber was Wolfgang Mann. But that would change very soon. Spitz looked at his wristwatch, counting down the seconds. Had any of the men of his Abteilung not been in position, the radio receiver built into the gas mask which Spitz wore would have been used, alerting him. Had one of his men failed, an alarm would have been sounded. At the least, an energy weapon discharged. The digital readout on the face of his wristwatch arrived at the 0 hour, and, in that very second, pneumatic weapons were fired from both sides of the great hall toward the 2 guards patrolling just before the 7 cryogenic sleeping chambers. Now all potential for resistance within the hall was quelled, and Helmut Spitz stood up, running across the vast emptiness toward the cryogenic chambers.
Quickly! Quickly!
The vidcams monitoring the hall were computer-linked and would by now register that there was something terribly wrong. But as long as silence was maintained, there might still be some precious moments before there was a full alert and the rest of the small but well-trained garrison turned out. Already, the 2 men of Spitz's Abteilung who had dispatched the last 2 guards had reached the 2 remaining cryogenic chambers. Without being told, Spitz's men set about laying out the explosive charges on the 2 still-occupied cryogenic chambers. Soon, history would be changed forever. Paul Rubinstein stared at John Rourke, watching the lines in his friend's face etch more deeply, it seemed, by the second. And John's hands were alternately twisted together as if 2 violently opposed living entities were struggling with one another and covering John's face. John stood in the private conference room adjoining Admiral Hayes' office at Pearl Harbor. Michael sat slumped in the far corner, Natalia standing beside him, nearly as motionless as a statue. Periodically, Natalia's hands would move as John would walk past her, as if to touch him, but she never did. Annie merely sat and stared at the wall, tears periodically overflowing her eyes and spilling down across her cheeks. Annie, Paul Rubinstein knew without being told, was undergoing an empathic experience with her father, adding his grief to her own. Thorn Rolvag, the volcanologist, was already airborne in a high-altitude observation craft for the purpose of studying the eruption of Kilauea, which had nearly claimed all of their lives. Both Rolvag's graduate student and the pilot of the helicopter, which had brought Rolvag in but could not get him out, were hospitalized and in good condition. One thing was in doubt, another a certainty. That which was in doubt was the fate of Commander Emma Shaw, who had violated orders, endangering her life and her aircraft in what turned out to be a successful attempt to rescue the person stranded on Kilauea. She had saved all their lives, except for those of Annie, Michael, and Natalia, who were still en route to the site of the eruption when Emma Shaw arrived there, and Paul did not delude himself as to why Emma Shaw had done so. She was in love with John Rourke. The door leading between Admiral Hayes' office and the private conference room opened. Emma Shaw stepped through, still wearing her flight suit, her helmet under her left arm. She ran the fingers of her right hand back through shoulder-length auburn hair that was losing its curl.
Well?
The Admiral will enter a reprimand on my personnel file. If within 6 months there's no similar incident, then it'll be removed. She pulled me off rescue duty for 2 days, told me I needed the rest. I tried talking myself back up, but she wouldn't go along with it.
A massive rescue effort was going on now to evacuate the population of the island of Hawaii because of the ongoing eruption.
She said there'll be plenty to do in 2 days. Even if the evacuation was completed, medical stuff and supplies and everything would have to be ferried out to the camps that are being set up. And Eden's forces are still massing for what looks like an attack. Admiral Hayes said I'd get plenty of flying in then.
Rest. You need it. And thank you from all of us, Emma.
John extended his right hand to her. She took it. They shook. She released his hand. She glanced at all of them briefly and left the room.
I think all of us need a rest. There's a lot to be done. And I have some thinking to do. Alone. All of you, I love you.
John Thomas Rourke stood on the summit of the mountain. When he looked to his left, he could see the ocean, limitless, the sun rising far off the windward coast. When he looked to his right, the darkness was not fading, the smoke and ash of Kilauea dominating the sky. But the sunrise was beautiful, beyond his descriptive powers. He had never been a man of many words. Beauty and darkness would soon meet above him. He felt almost evil, wasting ammunition, but he truly had plenty, and weapons in the calibers he used were not in the strategic inventory of the Transglobal Alliance. And he had come here to do this, at any event. He drew one of the little Deutonics Combat Master 45s from beneath his left armpit. He examined the gun closely. It was the one with his name on it, otherwise essentially identical to the gun beneath his right arm. His life was now nothing but ashes, like those at the tip of the thin, dark tobacco cigar he smoked, like the ashes spewing forth out of the volcano so far away, yet close. To have tried to sleep would have been an exercise in futility. He had killed his son, Martin, as surely as if he had shot him. And he had sealed his wife's doom, because without Martin there was no way in which he could coerce Dietrich Zimmer to utilize his almost magical surgical procedures to save Sarah's life. So, in one fateful instant, he had killed his son and effectively killed his wife. And John Rourke had never felt loneliness more intensely in his entire life. Even Natalia was totally gone from him. She would be happier with Michael anyway. This was a good place. A shot would never be heard, would disturb no one's pre-dawn sleep. John Rourke hefted the pistol in his right hand, then cocked the hammer. It was Admiral Hayes' voice on the telephone.
Yes, Admiral.
Mr. Rubenstein, I felt it best to speak with you concerning a very recent development. I'm afraid it's too tragic to discuss over the telephone, and I'll confess I don't think I have the courage to tell either your wife or your brother-in-law, or for that matter, Major Tiamarovna.
What is it?
There has been a death.
Paul Rubenstein felt the tendons in his neck go tight. She couldn't sleep. She didn't try. Maybe she would run over to the other side of the island after a while. A friend of hers owned one of the larger cattle ranches there and would lend her a horse. A ride really wouldn't help, but it was something to do. Emma Shaw stood on the front porch of her little house, changed out of her flight suit into a loosely woven, long-sleeved gray pullover sweater and a mid-calf-length full skirt, rose-colored, cotton like the sweater, with deep side-seam pockets, her hands buried in them. She wore no stockings and only wore flat sandals on her feet. And she was a little cold. Wrapped about her shoulders was one of her handicraft, the shawl she'd crocheted and practically hung under John Rourke's nose in order to impress him with how domestic she could be. It was just past dawn. She'd washed her hair twice as many times as usual in order to get the volcanic ash and dust out, turned up the hot water between showers and soaked under it for more than 15 minutes, trying to get the stuff from the pores of her skin.
Almost blew it this time, Emma.
She remembered what her portside engine air filter had looked like by the time she landed at Pearl. It was very much like a sandbox. She'd flown back to Pearl Harbor on 40% engine power. By the book, that wasn't enough with her weight load. But she'd made it anyway, by the seat of her pants. And that was the best way to fly, even in this era of computers and autopilots and everything else. If Admiral Hayes had brought her up on charges, if she'd been tossed out of the Navy, it would have been worth it.
I am so stupid.
Emma was in love for the first, and maybe the only time in her life. 2 days from now, she'd be back in the air, and in any minute the forces of Eden and their Nazi allies would launch an attack against the United States and the rest of the Transglobal Alliance. And she'd be in aerial combat, and maybe she would die. Takeoffs and landings from a carrier in rough seas were dangerous in and of themselves, not to mention other aircraft and ground batteries and everything. Paul Rubinstein sent Natalia over to keep his wife Annie company, not telling Natalia what Admiral Hayes had told him. He couldn't tell her, but he knew that soon he would have to. Tell Annie, tell Michael, too. He borrowed an FOUO car. Its tracer unit turned to the frequency of the FOUO car which John had taken when he drove off the base. This signal was strong. Paul followed it out of the city and into the mountains, along a highway that a few hours from now would be well-traveled during the rush hour, but now was all but deserted. He passed through small suburban Honolulu communities, climbing with the road, his eyes occasionally drifting down to the automatic controls which drove the car instead of him. He didn't trust them, kept his hands very lightly on the steering wheel, even though he didn't have to. What Admiral Hayes told him in the aftermath of Martin's death was almost beyond absorption. Tears still came to his eyes when he thought of it, and he would then focus his attention all the harder on the automobile's automatic controls as a means of forcing reality away from him. They, he and the car's computer, were out of any trace of real civilization now, and Paul Rubinstein, a New Yorker centuries ago, breathed more easily. Now cities compressed his spirit, were slightly maddening to him. It, the computer, kept driving, turning the car off onto an unpaved side road now. The car drove at a safe speed, neither so fast as to enable him to get this over with soon, nor so slow as to postpone the horrible inevitability. Instead, at what was the perfect speed, the computer drove him calmly toward what would be the worst moment of his life. It took a moment before Paul Rubinstein was able to see John Rourke. John lay against a rock as if asleep. Tears filled Paul Rubinstein's eyes as he forced his legs to move along the narrow, rocky trail. It was full daylight now. Admiral Hayes had offered to detail some men to accompany him, but he had told her simply that some things had to be done alone. First Martin, now this. One life that was evil and vile by any judgment, another that was noble and good, yet both lives shared the same genes. And how would he tell Annie? He'd have to tell her. It was only right that he did. He was as used to being orphaned as anyone ever got to it, Paul Rubinstein supposed. But how did one tell someone that a parent, a loved one, someone who had become quite literally larger than life because of circumstance, was dead? Paul reached the top of the rise, the end of the path. He stooped over to pick up a spent brass cartridge case. It was from a .45 ACP, one of the German production rounds, of course, but head-stamped as if it were made by Federal Cartridge, John's perennial brand of preference. Paul stared at John Rourke. He started to walk closer to him and the rock against which his friend lay. Why had this had to happen? It wasn't right.
It's not like you to come up so quietly, Paul. What's up? I came up here to think. I haven't had a shot for anything but self-defense in longer than I can remember. I can police up that brass. I just hadn't got around to it.
Gives me something to do.
What?
The cryogenic facility in New Germany was hit by Nazi commandos. Blew it up. Sarah and Colonel Mann are both dead.
He'd said it. He stayed there, crouched over the pieces of empty brass. John said nothing.
I didn't know how to tell you. Annie and Michael and Natalia don't know yet, but I'll tell them. I'm sorry, John. She was a magnificent woman. I don't know what else to say.
Jesus!
John stood up, walked to the edge of the drop, stood there, beating his right thigh with his right fist.
After all she went through! God! Sarah!
Paul Rubinstein opened his hands and let the empty brass fall through his fingers. His throat felt tight. He stood up, walked toward his friend, put his arms around him, and John Rourke rested his arm across Paul's shoulders and wept. Annie already knew that something terrible had happened, but not quite what. While Natalia kept talking with her, she dressed, telling Natalia nothing at all about her dream-initiated fears.
Michael's been thinking about trying to pass himself off as Martin with Dietrich Zimmer. I don't seem to be able to talk him out of it.
He shouldn't do that. There's been enough tragedy, Natalia. Besides, Michael could never convince Dietrich Zimmer. It would be like Martin having to try to convince Daddy that he was Michael instead. It'd never work.
I know that. But Michael feels he has to do something.
Men are crazy.
We let them be. Even admire it in them, don't we?
Paul is so sensible.
He's exciting. Trust me.
Oh, I didn't mean that.
I know you didn't mean anything.
It is only that Paul doesn't seem to have to be spectacular. That he does what needs to be done without any... what's the word?
Fanfare?
Yes, like that. Fanfare isn't the sort of word one uses every day, you know.
Michael is just like Daddy. He's naturally heroic. And it's unnatural for him to be otherwise. Paul is just naturally... competent. When it's competent to be heroic, he's heroic. But he doesn't go out of his way to constantly do that. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't define him.
Yes. I want Michael's baby. Can you imagine that? Me, a mother.
You'll make a wonderful mother! What's Michael think about it?
I haven't mentioned it to him, not yet anyway. Why did Paul go off like that, Annie?
I'm not sure. I think there's something going on and he didn't want to worry me. Could you do my eyes, Natalia? I've never been any good at it.
All right, sit down. How about a very pale blue?
It wouldn't be too much blue.
You're right. Here we go, close your eyes.
Getting her mind on something else had worked a little. But when she closed her eyes in order for Natalia to apply the eyeliner and eyeshadow, she didn't use mascara and hated the stuff anyway, Annie could still see the dream. It was as if she had been inside one of the cryogenic chambers in New Germany, and then there was fire and there were explosions. Perhaps she should have contacted the German authorities right away, alerted them, tell them she'd had a bad dream, that she never dreamed unless someone she loved was in danger. If Colonel Mann had not himself been in cryogenic sleep, he would have believed her. She was tempted to tell Natalia, but somehow felt she shouldn't. Not yet, at least.
There, kid. You look great.
You look great. I look... okay.
Annie went over to the mirror to inspect Natalia's handiwork.
You have to show me again sometime. I always get too much on, so it looks like I got my eyelids dirty or something. I had a dream.
Oh, God.
As Annie started to explain, she heard the door to the apartment opening. In the mirror, when she moved her head just right, she could see beyond the bedroom doorway and into the small living room. Paul, Michael, her father.
Annie!
In here! We're decent. Come on in, Paul.
She turned away from the mirror, looked at her husband as he filled the doorframe. He wasn't as tall as her father or her brother, but he was tall enough, and even though he was lean, he had good muscles and solid shoulders. There was a look of terrible sadness in his eyes.
It's Mama, isn't it?
Your mother's dead, Annie.
Her father wasn't even in the room as he spoke. Natalia ran back to the window, clutched at the curtains, leaned her head against the glass.
We're gonna get the damn...
Paul crossed the room, folded Annie into his arms. Annie realized only then that tears were already flowing down her cheeks. She thought absently that her eye makeup was waterproof. She closed her eyes as she sagged into her husband's arms.
The cryogenic chambers were burned, and there were explosions.
You should have said something.
But it was already done, wasn't it?
She doesn't know. She had a headache, was feeling sick to her stomach earlier. I suggested that she should lie down. She probably experienced it without knowing it, then only saw it after she was asleep.
Yes.
They'll pay, but never enough.
Annie pulled away a little from Paul's embrace and looked past him. She saw Michael, his head against the door jamb, his right forearm over his eyes, his body shaking. Natalia went to him. She saw her father, John, dark circles under his eyes, his face expressionless, his cheeks drawn down. The tendons of his neck, visible under the open collar of the black knit shirt he wore, pulsing.
Mama?
It was nearly 4 in the afternoon when Emma Shaw heard the crunch, the muted hum of synth rubber leaving pavement and coming onto gravel. The news broadcasts had been full of the events which had unfolded at New Germany in Argentina. The death of Sarah Rourke and of the heroic German General Wolfgang Mann at the hands of Nazi terrorist commandos almost overshadowed the continuing eruption of Mount Kilauea and its resultant devastation. There was definitely a car outside. Emma Shaw picked up the .45 automatic from under the couch and walked across the great room toward the windows. She almost dropped the gun when she looked out and realized that the man in the car was John Rourke. The driver's side door of the FOUO car was open, but John did not get out. He just sat there. Emma Shaw watched him, her hands shaking. She set down her gun, ran the palms of her hands over her skirt, dug her hands into the pockets in order to keep her hands from shaking. Now her shoulders trembled instead. Why had John Rourke come here?
Oh, God.
He just sat there, still. What was he doing? Should she go out onto the porch? And what would she say then? She couldn't say anything that wouldn't sound trite and at the same time cheap about them both. She saw a long-fingered, strong, graceful hand reach out to the door and pull it shut. Heard the soft purr as the electric motor restarted.
No!
She ran out onto the porch.
John, wait!
The car stopped. The door opened. Should she run to him? Should she... John Rourke stepped out of the car, and she took a step back, closer to her open door. John wore the same brown leather bomber jacket he'd worn when she'd picked him up off the slope of the volcano. The leather just as scarred and ash-smudged now as then. Black knit shirt, black BDU pants, black combat boots. A black mood? And why not? His wife and son dead within less than the span of a day. And he would blame himself. Men did that.
John?
He took off his dark-lensed aviator-style sunglasses, and she could tell from his eyes that he'd been crying.
I had nowhere else that I could go. No one else that I could talk to. Paul and Annie needed to be alone, and Michael and Natalia, too. It's my wife, you see. The Nazis killed her. I have to talk to somebody.
Emma Shaw's hands moved, jerky and awkward feeling, to her. Moved slowly toward John Rourke's face. Touched him gently. Caressed his face.
Talk to me.
John Rourke nodded.
And let me hold you.
Emma Shaw drew John Rourke's head down toward her, his arms folding gently around her, his head bowing.
I'm here for you, John.
For such a long time that her arms and legs began to go numb, she held him like that, afraid to let go of him, or that he would let go of her. Alternately, but not often, he would sip at one of the drinks on the table. One was a cup of decaffeinated coffee, which had to be cold by now, despite the self-warming cup in which she had served it. The other was a glass of red wine. Neither the coffee nor the wine was very much gone. She had finished her coffee, sipped at her wine, watched John Rourke from across the table, and listened.
We were really going to make it. The baby, the hospital, her work and mine. We were going to make it this time. No going off ever again, no leaving her. And after 125 years, Zimmer finished what he started.
My dad always told me that the one comfort he had as a cop was that the ones he didn't catch up with on this side, God'd catch up with them on the other side.
God won't have a chance, at least not before me, unless Zimmer drops dead before I find him.
There's a whole world war about to happen between you and him, John. May I see your lighter?
Of course.
Emma leaned forward, took it, leaned back in her chair, and turned it over in her hands. The lighter was bare brass, and she was uncertain whether it had started that way or had once been possessed of a finish. Engraved across the bottom, beneath the word Zippo, partially obscuring the words Bradford, PA, were the initials JTR.
How long have you had this, John?
Since I was a kid.
And you were always very careful with it. I don't mean the finish, but careful to keep it functional. Never lose it.
What's your point, Emma?
That sometimes we lose things, or people, even though we tried our best not to. And it's not your fault. When my mom died, for a long time I wondered if maybe something I'd done or hadn't done could have changed things. After a while, I guess I learned that nothing I could have done could have changed things. If you had a hole in your pocket and your lighter fell out, you might never find it.
Yeah, well, I know it sounds obsessive, but I always check my pocket seams before I put on a pair of pants. Same with jackets. And anyway, this is different.
Why? Because when the Nazis hit your hospital 125 years ago, you survived, she didn't survive as well? So you should be feeling guilty for living? I don't buy that, John. You want some dinner?
Maybe I should go.
Where?
I don't know.
You're the sensible one. Eating regular meals is good for your health. If you want to be healthy enough to go after the men you want to kill, then you'll need your strength.
What are you, my mother?
Maybe that's what you need, and maybe not, but that's not what I am. But I like cooking for you. You want some fresh coffee, or are you planning on poisoning your digestive system?
Well, since you put it that way.
She got up to start dinner. He ate a little, having no taste for it, despite the fact that she was right and the food was good. He'd eaten nothing all day. She sat across from him, looking at him now and again.
You're a good friend.
What's on your mind?
I don't know.
Rourke got up from the table, walked across the room, and went out onto the porch.
Those things taste any good?
What?
I asked if they taste any good. The cigars.
Oh, I like them.
Let me try. Nice. But these things will kill you, won't they?
My old ones would have. God, they don't make them like they used to. These came from Annie, who made them for me from her private collection. They're unique because it's Cuban seed, but it's grown in Germany.
And when there's the war, will the Germans fly them into Hawaii just for you?
You better believe it. They owe at least that.
But you'd go without before you do that. Smoke cigarettes? Strategic material would take preference, right?
Ah, I would.
But I suppose you've planned ahead, have a long-term supply laid up. Figured out what's on your mind yet?
No, not yet.
Don't suppose you know what's on mine?
I might.
You feel like you could burst inside because of what's happened?
Rourke didn't answer her.
Do you feel so sad you almost want to quit?
It's nice just to stand out here in the fresh air.
Sarah is dead. Natalia is Michael's woman. You're lonely. Everybody has somebody except you. I want you.
What?
Do you want me, John, like I want you? I love you. I don't expect you to love me back, but maybe it wouldn't hurt to be held, to let whatever happens happen. I mean, maybe I'm being awfully brazen or callous with what's just happened, and I'm sorry. But with the war coming, I'm afraid I might not make it and lose this one opportunity to be with you. I must admit, you've given it a good try, but even you're not immortal. I want you, John. However you'd like to have me. There, I've said it. And you think I'm a slut or an opportunist or what?
And I think you're a marvelous woman. I respect you.
Oh.
That's not what I meant.
What did you mean, John?
I don't know what I feel, but what I mean. But you were right. Being with you, I mean,
Are you thinking of kissing me, John?
I might.
Well, then what are you waiting for?
John Rourke, his hands moving down across her arms to her waist, settling there, drew Emma Shaw up and toward him, lowering his face to hers. He looked at her. He folded her into his arms. John Rourke touched his lips lightly to Emma Shaw's lips, then crushed her against him, his mouth hard against hers, her mouth opening beneath him, her body going limp in his arms, molding against his thighs, his abdomen, his chest. His fingers wove more deeply into her hair, the nape of her neck in the crook of his left elbow. The fingers of his right hand splayed over her, rising from her waist and across her back. Rourke bent over her, kissed her mouth, her cheek, then her mouth again. John Rourke swept Emma Shaw up into his arms, cradling her there against his body. Wilhelm Doring watched as the old man from the little diner, Luther Haas, the ranking Nazi intelligence controller in the Hawaiian Islands, conversed with these racially objectionable persons he had hired as assassins. Doring watched and he listened.
You all know what to do. Nikita, why don't you go over it once more,
Right, Mr. Haas.
Nikita was a tall, broad-shouldered expatriate Soviet, involved in the drug trade here in the islands, and credited, as Luther Haas recounted it, with several contract hits on behalf of the party, and many more, which he privately arranged.
We'll take the house from the north. The woman is our main objective. But if there's anybody else inside, leave none alive. Don't blow the damn place, because we want the son of a bitch cop Tim Shaw to know he fucked with the wrong people this time.
Exactly, Nikita. One more thing. You will carve a swastika on the dead body of Shaw's daughter, then get out of there. Now you and your men will be on your way. And remember that the man with her is John Rourke. He did not survive all these years by being inept, hmm? Heil Zimmer!
Yeah, sure thing, Mr. Haas.
Nikita shook his head, shaking his shoulder-length blonde hair as he walked off. Doring looked after Nikita, watching as he walked down the hillside toward the 10 men waiting for him. All of them were armed with caseless projectile firearms, not a plasma energy weapon among them. The house that Commander Shaw had lay across a narrow valley, which looked like it might once have been a river course. Through binoculars, Doring had watched the disgusting scene between Rourke and the woman. And how appropriate it would be to have this despicable Rourke fellow turn up dead in this love nest with his little naval officer whore. When Herr Haas had insisted on contracting a revenge plot against the American policeman, Inspector Shaw, for half the deaths of Doring's commando team, Wilhelm Doring had been against it. He and his 4 men were more than adequate to the task. He discounted Marie Dreisling completely. But Herr Haas had insisted that Doring not risk the remainder of his unit in an unplanned operation, and that speed of retribution was required. Hence Nikita and his drug friends. But now, having seen Dr. Rourke, Wilhelm Doring felt even worse about at last agreeing to Herr Haas's plan. These 11 scurvy fellows were easily too many to deal with Fräulein Commander Emma Shaw. Were they enough? How were these street ruffians, thugs, to deal with the almost legendary Dr. John Rourke? To have gone with these men would have been madness, however. If they were good, they could succeed on their own. If they were not, and he accompanied them, they would succeed only in getting him killed, perhaps. So he waited. They stood together, each watching through night vision binoculars. Rourke and the woman had to be inside the bedroom by now. John Rourke's hands moved over her body, his touch easy, much like his first night with his wife. But he quickly pushed her memory from his mind as he gently and slowly removed her blouse, one button at a time. Her shirt slipped down her arms, revealing the natural curves of her breasts, still tucked behind a silk lace bra that was clasped behind her back. He reached for the clasp, and at the moment he touched it, it sprang free and the bra fell loose, revealing to Rourke the full beauty of her bare chest. He paused for a brief moment, almost in an admiring memory of when the last time was he saw a beautiful woman, naked for him. Emma, sensing his pause, reached up, pulling his mouth back to hers, and kissed him once again. At last, she was naked. She thought she should be trembling, but instead she felt safe, happy that she was finally going to have Rourke, and because of that she grinned a quick smile to herself. John was stripped to the waist, and he was magnificent. Shoulders almost terrifyingly broad, his arms and his chest veritably rippled with muscles at his slightest movement. Her hands caressed his bare back, powerful, hard. The hair on his chest was more than partially gray, but it was the only bodily sign that he could have been much more than 30 years old. Even though she knew that biologically he was closer, one side or the other, to 40. His stomach was flat, muscled and hard too. There were no scars on his body, and for a moment she was amazed that with all his near-death encounters, just those talked about in the history books, he remained unscathed. But she remembered a property of cryogenic sleep. Biology was never one of her strong points in school. It was discovered that cryogenic sleep had a restorative effect on the human body, curing minor illnesses, even healing the skin, as if the body, given time to rest, could repair itself.
What are you thinking, Emma?
How good you look and how much I love you.
Are you sure?
Uh-huh. Never sure of anything in my life. You?
Yeah.
Rourke started to open his trouser belt.
Wait a minute. You undressed me. Let me undress you.
Well, if you want.
There was a far-off look in his eyes, sadness mingled with loneliness. And more than ever, she wanted this to be the best moment in John Rourke's life, just as she knew it would be the best moment in hers. She started to undo his belt, her lips touching at his abdomen, at his chest, at his throat, her bare body against his chest, her breasts hot, her nipples feeling so hard she could barely stand it. She opened the button at the waistband of his trousers.
We're not alone.
She looked over into his eyes, then looked away and glanced to her right, but without moving her head. He was right. They weren't alone. Her .45 was in the great room by the front door. Her Lancer pistol was on the kitchen table. She'd disassembled it for cleaning, then gotten caught up in the television broadcasts about Sarah Rourke and not reassembled it yet. John Rourke's little pistols, every school kid grew up knowing they were Detonic's .45s, were still in their shoulder holsters on the chair in front of her dressing table, the chair halfway between the foot of the bed and the door. His little knife, the black double-edged one he usually carried inside the waistband of his trousers, was with the guns. The noise had been from beyond the doorway in the great room.
When I tell you to, you drop to the floor, Emma. Grab my shirt, as you do, and I'm going to get my guns. If there's trouble, you run for it. Get to the car and get out of here.
His right hand left her body for a split second, then returned, something cold in it, as he pressed his hand against her left breast. She realized it was a coded car entry key, the one to the electric car in which he'd driven here. John slid his hand down along her body to the left cheek of her rear, and she felt the coded entry key slipped under her between the flesh of her bottom and her calf.
I really love you.
Now!
His hands were gone from her in the same instant as he spoke, his body a blur of movement, racing away from the bed and toward the chair where his guns lay. For a split second, Emma Shaw was powerless to move. The bedroom door was already open. Two men came through, submachine guns in their hands. John wasn't going to make it to his guns. John's right hand clasped to his belt buckle, ripping his belt from the trouser loops, snapping it outward toward the face of the man nearest to him. John's left hand reached out to the double shoulder holster for his guns. He swung both pistols outward. The two pistols John swung in the shoulder holster hit the second man on the side of the head. Emma Shaw rolled off the bed, grabbing for John's black knit shirt with one hand, the coded entry card for the electric car with the other. But she had no intention of using it. She pulled the shirt on over her head, stuffing her arms into the sleeves, the garment impossibly large for her. John had his double shoulder holster in his left hand, was reaching with his other hand for a submachine gun which lay on the floor next to one of the men, unconscious or dead. From behind her, Emma Shaw saw one of the bedroom windows shattering. She wheeled round 180 degrees, grabbing the lamp from the nightstand and hurling it toward the man coming through the window. John, at last, had one of the pistols free, stabbing it toward the man leveling a submachine gun at John's chest. Emma Shaw reached out and rolled, grabbing for the submachine gun John had reached for instants earlier.
Head down!
She dropped to her knees, careful as she could be to avoid the glass shards.
Run for it!
Emma Shaw ran for the window, starting to clamber up, but John swept her up into his left arm, half throwing her through the shot-out window. She dropped to the ground, stumbling, getting to her feet. John vaulted through, reaching down to the dead man just beside the house wall, grabbing up the dead man's submachine gun.
Now watch your bare feet!
She ran beside him as he ran, seeing him hurl away one of the submachine guns, empty she assumed, and redraw the little Detonic's .45 from his trouser band. They ran along the wall of the house toward the front where John's car was parked. Her own car was garaged and impossible to get to, she realized. As John turned the front corner of the house, Emma Shaw beside him, three men rose up from behind the FOUO vehicle in which he had driven here, toward which they had been running. Chunks of the outside wall shredded under the impact of the bullets, and John knocked her breathless, slamming her back against the wall behind the corner.
You all right?
Sure. I'm more than half naked. Some damn assholes shot up my house, and I'll just bet I won't get you back into bed with me.
You're a wonderfully candid person.
What are we gonna do, John?
I'm gonna give you both submachine guns. You watch out behind you. How many there are? I'm going up on the roof. You fire a couple of shots, not more than three if you can manage that short a burst. You don't have more than a dozen rounds left in it.
What are you gonna do on the roof?
I'm gonna kill those men. I wish I had some pliers.
Pliers?!
But John Rourke was already moving. His old OSS friend years ago had related to him once how two pairs of pliers were used in conjunction with a gutter downspout to climb to the roof of a building. John Rourke didn't even have one set of pliers, but he climbed the downspout anyway. His hands worked along the downspout, his feet locked around it, helping to shove him upward along its length. He was halfway to the roof. He was at the peak of the roof. He could see the three men clearly. and as yet, they clearly did not see him. There were 3 rounds remaining in one of his twin stainless Katonix 45s, 6 in the other. Although functionally perfectly ambidextrous all his life, the right was his master hand. He shifted the pistol with 3 rounds to his left hand, the one with 6 in his right. Straddling the peak of the roof, Rourke rose up to his knees, both pistols cocked and locked.
Up here!
The 3 men wheeled their weapons toward him. The slide of the pistol in John Rourke's left hand was locked open, empty. 4 rounds remained in the pistol he held in his right hand. The 3 men were down without firing a shot in return.
Stay where you are, Emma, in case there's any more of them!
Rourke was already moving along the roofline and lowering his body profile just in case. Tim Shaw's eyes were on his daughter's clothing. He would have expected grass stains or something on her skirt, but there were none. And he looked at John Rourke and wondered. In all, there were 11 dead men here, and like Nikita Kamazov, who was one of them, they were all in the drug trade. Most of them documented killers, all of them armed with submachine guns. And John Rourke had killed them all, the majority of them, inside Tim Shaw's daughter's bedroom.
Dr. Rourke, these guys just...
Yeah?
One father to another, huh?
Yeah.
But Tim Shaw didn't know what to say. After all, Emma was a grown woman, and even though John Rourke had a daughter close to her age, it wasn't as if John was anywhere near old enough to be her father. Rourke had to be about 40. Rourke's children were as old as they were because Rourke had played games with the cryogenic sleep process, intentionally aging them into adulthood. Everybody grew up reading the story in history books.
Just wanted to say I'm sorry about the death of your wife. Real sorry. Lost mine when Emma was just a tyke.
Thank you.
These guys just popped in on you?
Your daughter and I were in the bedroom, as you've obviously deduced. And judging from the condition of her clothing, no blood stains, no grass stains, no mud, you've probably guessed at a few other things, too. Look, gentlemen, don't discuss personal relationships with women, as we both know. Under the circumstances, however, suffice it to say that I was feeling terrible, and I still do. Your daughter, a friend, was very kind to me. She's as fine a woman as I've ever had the good fortune to know.
No.
Whatever might have happened was never allowed to happen by the circumstances attendant to what you see here.
And Rourke gestured toward 2 of the morgue men who were carrying a body in a black rubber bag on a stretcher between them.
Okay, John. Who you think these guys were after?
I wasn't followed up here, and the FOUO car was randomly selected, so I doubt there was any electronic trace. I'd say the Nazis hired these men to go after your daughter as part of a revenge plot against you. Get her out of here. Back on base would be safest.
One of her damn airplanes. The bastards. Can't come after me. Gotta go after my daughter.
For the operation you pulled off at that condo, when you nailed 6 of the ones who did the massacre at Sebastian's Reef Country Day School, you got 6 of their people and you got a lot of their equipment. If there were 12, as we suspect, you cut their commando group by 50%. I mean, it's easy to see why they'd want back at you.
Tim Shaw looked toward the house's little front porch. Emma sat on the railing, her skirt sagging down between her knees, her hands kind of buried inside it. And she looked sadder than he'd ever seen her look since her mother died.
None of my business, but... Do you love her?
I don't know. I get the impression with all the things they've put in history books about me, and that's stupid, because I didn't do anything special. But that people think I'm supposed to be some guy out of a novel or a movie or a graphic audio recording.
You mean people expect you to be more than human, and that means less than human.
I lost my wife. I just killed my son. My head isn't on straight. I don't really know what I know, except Emma's a marvelous person. Does that make any sense, Tim?
Yeah, probably, John. If anything does these days.
Emma Shaw watched the 2 men she loved. She loved her brother, of course, but that was different. And it was a different sort of love, too, of course, that she had for her dad, Tim Shaw, the cop. Different from the way she loved John Rourke. And now it was over before it was begun. She just sat there on the porch railing, hands clasped in each other between her knees. When she swung her feet forward, she could see them beneath the hem of her skirt. When she swung them back, it was as if they weren't there. She was perched, waiting, waiting for her father to say something, maybe even for John to say something. But she'd said it all to herself already. This was too soon for John, too soon after the death of Sarah Rourke. And maybe she'd messed up any chance they might have had in the future. And her father was too good a detective not to have figured out why all the carnage within the house was confined to the bedroom. As she watched her father and John still talking, one of the shore patrol investigators began walking hurriedly from his car toward them. Emma Shaw swung her legs around and hopped off the railing, started walking across the porch, then started running down the low steps across the yard where evidence technicians still worked, and only a little while ago there had been three dead men. She quickened her pace now, seeing the shore patrol investigator, Lieutenant Ned Barringer, approaching her father and John. He gave the usual salute military people give to important civilians. And, after all, John was technically a general. John nodded to him. She slowed her pace and stopped a few feet away from John and her father and Lieutenant Barringer. She could hear what he was saying.
Received word from Dietrich Zimmer, sir. The communique starts that despite the damage done to the cryogenic repository in New Germany, both Mrs. Rourke and General Oberst Mann are alive, in cryogenic sleep, and will be traded for Martin Zimmer. But if there is no trade, they will be killed. We're working on getting independent confirmation now, but the message source appears to be genuine, sir. Not one body has yet been found in the wreckage of the cryogenic repository. The fires caused by the explosion are still burning, but the German government says it will send a team in fire-resistant gear to check. That may take several hours.
You mean to say they never fucking checked?
John didn't say anything. The pale blue gas swirled away for an instant. She had a lovely face, just as he remembered it from that brief moment 125 years ago when there had been the shared communion of death between them. He the giver, she the receiver. Her hair, almost too meticulously brushed it seemed, almost funereally perfect, was a rich dark auburn, the arrangement softening with time. The hair grew, of course. General Oberst Wolfgang Mann's hair was well past military length, and a healthy growth of beard adorned Mann's traitorous countenance. Dietrich Zimmer's thoughts returned to Sarah Rourke. With her eyelids down, of course, it was impossible to see her eyes. But he remembered them as they had been in that instant more than a century ago when they had flashed up at him defiantly, proudly. She was, of course, a remarkable woman, full of courage and strength and determination, and not at all unattractive. She was the mother of his son. Several courses of action lay open to him now, possessed of her body as he was. With her, he would assuredly be able to trade for the return of Martin. With her, he could control John Rourke, and hence, at least to some degree, control the Trans-Global Alliance's attempts to interdict his actions. Zimmer looked past the cryogenic chamber in which she lay, toward the wall, which was covered by a mural-sized video screen, a map displayed on it, showing the constantly updated positions of forces of the Reich and of Eden, all but one and the same. The attack on Pearl Harbor would be critical, of course, and with the good Dr. Rourke out of the way, there would be a decided advantage. He, Zimmer, would arrange the trade for young Martin in such a manner that John Rourke would have to accomplish the trade himself. And he, Zimmer, would not only have Martin back, but have John Rourke as his prisoner, or dead. But he hoped for the former. The latter, an eventuality, coming to pass all in due time. And if the good Dr. Rourke had any compunction about personally involving himself in the trade, that would fade away instantly. In the event that he was unable to carry out his plan of preference, he had made arrangements to accomplish his intended scheme by other means. A video crew and specialists in laser holography would be his ace in the hole, as the Americanism went. This promised not only to be challenging, but amusing as well. The one problem with his ice-bound redoubt was that there were no windows, and he felt just slightly claustrophobic. The feelings passed with activity, of course, and there would be an adequate supply of that. There was a secret, and he must know it, possess that secret himself. And the secret was the greatest prize, even greater than the death, final and complete and ultimate, of Dr. John Thomas Rourke. And only John Rourke could unlock that secret, retrieve this knowledge. The ultimate knowledge posed the ultimate risk, of course. But what knowledge was, after all, without risk to the knower? Dietrich Zimmer licked his lips. He could taste it.
It's very simple to give you artificial fingerprints, Mr. Rourke, but that's the least of your worries.
Natalia watched Michael's eyes as they squinted slightly, and the doctor from the police department forensics unit continued.
You can get anyone to alter your fingerprints, either temporarily or permanently. Corneal imprint is what's most reliable. But you have to remember that Dietrich Zimmer, when he isn't being a Nazi dictator, is one of the finest medical minds ever. What's known of Zimmer's techniques, and that's precious little, is studied in medical schools from New Germany to Lidvildid Island to the Chinese First City to Midwick. Hell, you name it. He's going to be able to spot fingerprint changes unless they're done perfectly. And he might even spot them then. And what will you do about cranial measurements, dental records? No, you could pull off a deception that would last until he examined you. That's it, Mr. Rourke.
I have to try.
Michael, the moment he heard about Dietrich Zimmer's communique, was determined to go through with the charade he had planned before the, thank God, totally erroneous information concerning his mother's death.
Think of it this way. Dr. Zimmer may be evil incarnate, I don't know. But I do know he's not a fool. He knows you exist, and he knows you've impersonated Martin successfully once before. He will anticipate it, Mr. Rourke. I read somewhere that you once entertained plans for following in your father's footsteps in medicine.
I still do, maybe.
Well, then put yourself in Zimmer's place, for goodness sake. He'll be expecting to be deceived. If Martin Zimmer were still alive, and your father actually brought Martin Zimmer in trade for your mother's life, Dietrich Zimmer would check Martin Zimmer just as carefully. From what you've told me this evening, and from the scuttlebutt I've picked up, it seems clear that Dietrich Zimmer essentially built Martin Zimmer. He started with the raw clay of your brother, added surgically the genetic material from a descendant of Adolf Hitler, made Martin. Don't you think he'd know every measurement it was possible to know? Every minute scar? Every blemish? You don't even know if Martin Zimmer was circumcised. Were you? How are you going to check now with Martin's body buried under a couple of tons of still molten lava in Kilauea? I don't mean to be too blunt, Mr. Rourke, but you'd never get away with it. What would you do? Pursuing the thing with the circumcision, for example, if before he did the trade, he asked Martin to drop...
pants?
Yes.
I'd piss in his face, all right?
Stop being macho and be smart. As long as he can examine you, Michael, you cannot hope to succeed.
That's it.
What is it, Michael?
What the hell are you laughing at, Mr. Rourke?
They put me into cryogenic sleep, but with two gases. My father has a remote. He lets off the finger pressure, like what they used to call a dead man switch, and the other gas flows into the chamber.
What other gas?
Cyanide.
John Rourke poured a glass of his German-made Seagram 7 into the small tumbler and sipped at it. He was watching the white-foamed surf breaking over the slick blackness of the rocks. This was his second small glass of whiskey in 2 hours. He had no intention of getting drunk, nor had he ever been so by design or otherwise. But John Rourke couldn't sleep. Too much had happened for him to be able to properly deal with it. Less than 24 hours ago, he had precipitated the death of his third child, Martin Zimmer. Then he was informed that his wife was dead, and along with her, his old friend and comrade, Wolfgang Mann. Then, out of despair and loneliness, in seeking the comfort of a woman, he had betrayed his wife, cheated on her, albeit unknowingly and incompletely, but not for lack of trying on his part. Fate intervened in the form of the 11 men sent to kill Emma Shaw in her home. In the aftermath of this episode, he was informed that, in fact, his wife was not dead, nor was Wolfgang Mann. The news that Sarah lived filled his heart with happiness, but even in that very moment, his joy was muted by the fact that her life still hung in the balance in two ways. He was not certain of just how yet, but in some way he had to force Dietrich Zimmer to perform a life-saving operation to remove from Sarah's brain the bullet which Dietrich Zimmer himself had put there. And he had to get Sarah away from Zimmer. Even in this modern age of highly advanced medical technology and speeded-up healing, there would be a reasonable limit to how far and how fast someone recovering from brain surgery of the most delicate nature could be moved. And there was the matter of the trade itself, in order to be in a position to accomplish all or any of this. Martin, the person for whom Dietrich Zimmer wished to trade, was dead. Michael clung stubbornly to the idea of impersonating Martin, indeed their only viable option, but one which would not get them very far at all, and in the end might result in Michael's death as well. And if, through some miraculous combination of luck on their part and ineptitude on the part of their adversaries, Sarah was saved, once she was well enough, John Rourke would have to tell her that Martin was dead, killed by his father's hand. Regardless of the circumstances, Martin had been attempting to destroy the aircraft which Emma piloted, endeavoring to force it down into the volcanic lava flows below, killing them all. Martin's death was a fact. Sarah would never forgive him, John Rourke, for that. And their marriage would end. He finished his drink, then sat there for a time longer, smoking his cigar. In the morning, he would embark upon the most desperate gamble of his life. Tonight, he would be alone with his thoughts.